Chapter 30. A profound stillness reigned in the Casa Gould. The master of the house, walking along the corridor, opened the door of his room, and saw his wife sitting in a big armchair, his own smoking armchair, thoughtful, contemplating her little shoes. And she did not raise her eyes when he walked in. "Tired?" asked Charles Gould. "A little," said Mrs. Gould. Still without looking up, she added with feeling, "There is an awful sense of unreality about all this." Charles Gould, before the long table strewn with papers, on which lay a hunting crop and a pair of spurs, stood looking at his wife. "Colin, the heat and dust must have been awful this afternoon by the waterside," he murmured, sympathetically. "Tea, the glare on the water must have been simply terrible." "One could close one's eyes to the glare," said Mrs. Gould. "But, my dear Charlie, it is impossible for me to close my eyes to our position, to this awful." Dot, she raised her eyes and looked at her husband's face, from which all sign of sympathy or any other feeling had disappeared. "Why don't you tell me something?" she almost wailed. "I thought you had understood me perfectly from the first," Charles Gould said, slowly. I thought we had said all there was to say a long time ago. There is nothing to say now. There were things to be done. We have done them. We have gone on doing them. There is no going back now. I don't suppose that, even from the first, there was really any possible way back. And, what's more, we can't even afford to stand still." "Ah, if one only knew how far you mean to go," said his wife, inwardly trembling, but in an almost playful tone. "Any distance, any length, of course," was the answer, in a matter-of-fact tone, which caused Mrs. Gould to make another effort to repress a shudder. She stood up, smiling graciously, and her little figure seemed to be diminished still more by the heavy mass of her hair and the long train of her gown. "But all was to success," she said, persuasively. Charles Gould, enveloping her in the steely blue glance of his attentive eyes, answered without hesitation, "Oh, there is no alternative." He put an immense assurance into his tone. As to the words, this was all that his conscience would allow him to say. Mrs. Gould's smile remained a shade too long upon her lips. She murmured, "I will leave you. I've a slight headache." "The heat, the dust, were indeed, I suppose you are going back to the mine before the morning?" "At midnight," said Charles Gould. "We are bringing down the silver tomorrow. Then I shall take 3 whole days off in town with you." "Ah, you are going to meet the escort. I shall be on the balcony at 5 o'clock to see you pass. Till then, goodbye." Charles Gould walked rapidly round the table, and, seizing her hands, bent down, pressing them both to his lips. Before he straightened himself up again to his full height as he had disengaged one to smooth his cheek with a light touch, as if he were a little boy. "Try to get some rest for a couple of hours," she murmured, with a glance at a hammock stretched in a distant part of the room. Her long train swished softly after her on the red tiles. At the door she looked back. 2 big lamps with unpolished glass globes bathed in a soft and abundant light the 4 white walls of the room, with a glass case of arms, the brass hilt of Henry Gould's cavalry saber on its square of velvet, and the watercolor sketch of the Santome Gorge. And Mrs. Gould, gazing at the last in its black wooden frame, sighed out, "Ah, if we had left it alone, Charlie." "No," Charles Gould said, moodily, "it was impossible to leave it alone." "Perhaps it was impossible," Mrs. Gould admitted, slowly. Her lips quivered a little, but she smiled with an air of dainty bravado. "We have disturbed a good many snakes in that paradise, Charlie, haven't we?" "Yes, I remember," said Charles Gould. "It was Don Peep who called the gorge the paradise of snakes. No doubt we have disturbed a great many. But remember, my dear, that it is not now as it was when you made that sketch." He waved his hand towards the small watercolor hanging alone upon the great bare wall. "It is no longer a paradise of snakes. We have brought mankind into it, and we cannot turn our backs upon them to go and begin a new life elsewhere. He confronted his wife with a firm, concentrated gaze, which Mrs. Gould returned with a brave assumption of fearlessness, before she went out, closing the door gently after her. In contrast with the white glaring room, the dimly lit corridor had a restful mysteriousness of a forest glade, suggested by the stems and the leaves of the plants ranged along the balustrade of the open side. In the streaks of light falling through the open doors of the reception rooms, the blossoms, white and red and pale lilac, came out vivid with the brilliance of flowers in a stream of sunshine, and Mrs. Gould, passing on, at the vividness of a figure seen in the clear patches of sun that checker the gloom of open glades in the woods. The stones in the rings upon her hand pressed to her forehead glittered in the lamplight abreast of the door of the sala. "Who's there?" she asked, in a startled voice. "Is that you, Basilio?" She looked in, and saw Martin Deckard walking about, with an air of having lost something, amongst the chairs and tables. "Antonia has forgotten her fan in here," said Deckard, with a strange air of distraction, "so I entered to see." But, even as he said this, he had obviously given up his search, and walked straight towards Mrs. Gould, who looked at him with doubtful surprise. "Senora," he began, in a low voice. "What is it, Don Martin?" asked Mrs. Gould. And then she added, with a slight laugh, "I am so nervous today," as if to explain the eagerness of the question. "Nothing immediately dangerous," said Deckard, who now could not conceal his agitation. "Pray don't distress yourself." "No, really, you must not distress yourself." Mrs. Gould, with her candid eyes very wide open, her lips composed into a smile, was steadying herself with a little bejeweled hand against the side of the door. "Perhaps you don't know how alarming you are, appearing like this unexpectedly, I..." "Alarming?" he protested, sincerely vexed and surprised. "I assure you that I am not in the least alarmed myself. A fan is lost. Well, it will be found again. But I don't think it is here. It is a fan I am looking for. I cannot understand how Antonia could well. Have you found it, amigo?" "No, senor," said behind Mrs. Gould the soft voice of Basilio, the head servant of the casa. I don't think the senorita could have left it in this house at all. Go and look for it in the patio again. Go now, my friend. Look for it on the steps, under the gate. Examine every flagstone. Search for it till I come down again." That fellow, he addressed himself in English to Mrs. Gould, as always stealing up behind one's back on his bare feet. "I set him to look for that fan directly I came in to justify my reappearance, my sudden return." He paused and Mrs. Gould said, amiably, "You are always welcome." She paused for a second to be, "But I am waiting to learn the cause of your return." Deckard affected suddenly the utmost nonchalance. "I can't bear to be spied upon." "Oh, the cause?" "Yes, there is a cause. There is something else that is lost besides Antonia's favorite fan. As I was walking home after seeing Don Jose and Antonia to their house, the Capitas de Cargadores, riding down the street, spoke to me." "Has anything happened to the violas?" inquired Mrs. Gould. "The violas? You mean the old Garibaldino who keeps the hotel where the engineers live?" "Nothing happened there. The Capitas said nothing of them. He only told me that the telegraphist of the cable company was walking on the plaza, bareheaded, looking out for me. There is news from the interior, Mrs. Gould. I should rather say rumors of news." "Good news?" said Mrs. Gould in a low voice. "Worthless, I should think. But if I must define them, I would say bad. They are to the effect that a 2 days' battle had been fought near Sta. Marta, and that the Ribierists are defeated. It must have happened a few days ago, perhaps a week. The rumor has just reached Cata, and the man in charge of the cable station there has telegraphed the news to his colleague here. We might just as well have kept Barrios in Sulaco. What's to be done now? murmured Mrs. Gould. Nothing. He's at sea with the troops. He will get to Cayda in a couple of days' time, and learn the news there. What he will do then, who can say? Hold Cayda? Offer his submission to Montero? Disband his army this last most likely, and go himself in one of the O.S.S. N. Company steamers, north or south to Valparaiso, or to San Francisco, no matter where. Arbarios has a great practice in exiles and repatriations, which mark the points in the political game. Decade, exchanging a steady stare with Mrs. Gould, added, tentatively, as it were, and yet, if we had, could have been done. Montero victorious, completely victorious. Mrs. Gould breathed out in a tone of unbelief. A canard, probably. That sort of bird is hatched in great numbers in such times as these. And even if it were true? Well, let us put things at their worst, let us say it is true. Then everything is lost, said Mrs. Gould, with the calmness of despair. Suddenly she seemed to divine, she seemed to see Deckard's tremendous excitement under its cloak of studied carelessness. It was, indeed, becoming visible in his audacious and watchful stare, in the curve, half reckless, half contemptuous, of his lips. And a French phrase came upon them as if, for this Castaguanero of the boulevard, that had been the only forcible language, non, madame. Rien n'est perdu. It electrified Mrs. Gould out of her benumbed attitude, and she said, vivaciously, what would you think of doing? But already there was something of mockery in Deckard's suppressed excitement. What would you expect a true Castaguanero to do? Another revolution, of course. On my word of honor, Mrs. Gould, I believe I am a true Hijo del Pais, a true son of the country, whatever Father Corbelin may say. And I'm not so much of an unbeliever as not to have faith in my own ideas, in my own remedies, in my own desires. Yes, said Mrs. Gould, doubtfully. You don't seem convinced, Deckard went on again in French. Essay, then, in my passions. Mrs. Gould received this addition unflinchingly. To understand it thoroughly she did not require to hear his muttered assurance, there is nothing I would not do for the sake of Antonia. There is nothing I am not prepared to undertake. There is no risk I am not ready to run. Deckard seemed to find a fresh audacity in this voicing of his thoughts. Why you would not believe me, if I were to say, that it is the love of the country which, she made a sort of discouraged protest with her arm, as if to express that as he had given up expecting, that motive from anyone. A Sulaco revolution, Deckard pursued in a forcible undertone. The great cause may be served here, on the very spot of its inception, in the place of its birth, Mrs. Gould. Frowning, and biting her lower lip thoughtfully, she made a step away from the door. You are not going to speak to your husband? Deckard arrested her anxiously. But you will need his help? No doubt, Deckard admitted without hesitation. Very thing turns upon the Santome mine, but I would rather he didn't know anything as yet of my hopes. A puzzled look came upon Mrs. Gould's face, and Deckard, approaching, explained confidentially, don't you see, he's such an idealist. Mrs. Gould flushed pink, and her eyes grew darker at the same time. Charlie an idealist, she said, as if to herself, wonderingly. What on earth do you mean? Yes, conceded Deckard, it's a wonderful thing, to say with the sight of the Santome mine, the greatest fact in the whole of South America, perhaps, before our very eyes. But look even at that, he has idealized this fact to a point, he paused. Mrs. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.